Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Well, hello, Felicity. You're recently back from a whistle stop tour to the West Coast US. You were in Oregon, I believe.
I was. I was giving a talk to a university on wine and health, and I went on telly.
Oh, get you and being famous going on the telly. How was that?
Well, it's been a really long time since I was in a television studio, and the camera people don't exist anymore. They have these cameras and now automatic, these big sort of Dalek-like creatures. And so you have these three machines in front of you that are constantly moving into position. And they don't have makeup artists anymore, which was disastrous.
Oh my goodness me, you diva, so you didn't have your own makeup.
No, I had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and I just assumed that somebody would be there to do makeup because this was always happened in the past. Anyway, so there was nobody there, so I had to borrow some makeup off the receptionist and the only thing she had was powder that turned me orange.
Okay, so there's an irony in that.
Yeah, there is.
So do you think it's like only orange-tinted face powder is now available in America?
I think that's how it works, Lily.
Is there like a tariff now that is on face powder that isn't orange?
I think that's right. I think that's exactly how the orange powder ended up on that front desk.
Okay. Now I'm regretting making a joke about tariffs, given what's going on and the depth of uncertainty and impacts that are happening on and off in so many industries and in ours as well, in drinks. So probably not the right things.
The impact is being felt globally. I mean, people are just frozen at the moment. So speaking of being frozen, what have you been up to, Lily?
Well, I've actually been on holiday, Felicity.
You've been on holiday?
For our American friends. I have. And I discovered that I actually really like rum, which I kind of knew, but I particularly discovered that I really like coconut rum. Who knew?
Okay, so you went to the Caribbean, I take it.
Yeah, so I feel a bit of a diva and very spoiled, but yes, I did. I went to the Bahamas and it was very lovely.
Do you know, 25 years ago, I went to Barbados and they had so much rum everywhere and nothing worked. So you'd go to some tourist thing and it didn't run on time. So what they do is they just plonk a daiquiri in front of you or a bottle of rum and Coke. It was just the sort of way of saying, sorry, this isn't going to happen for a while, but here, enjoy yourself. It was great.
It was a very happy holiday for everyone.
It was a very, very happy holiday. Good memories.
Yes. But anyway, before we get into today's question, Felicity, so did you go out and have a pint of Guinness as you promised you would at the end of our last episode?
No, really, I didn't. But I did have a lot of Oregonian Pinot Noir. It was lovely.
Yeah, I know, that's really nice, but that's not the point. So, okay, you could say, if one was being sort of disingenuous, you could say that perhaps you hadn't done quite as much homework as I did for the Guinness episode, given that I did WSET Level 1 and went to Dublin for 2 days, and all you had to do was go and drink a pint of Guinness.
Yeah, that's true. But you're going to have to give me some time to complete this task because I need to be travelling somewhere to buy it.
Okay, I'm not really buying that excuse. You were in an airport, okay? So there must have been Guinness there.
Do you know, I didn't actually think about that. But I am travelling again this week. I'm going to a wine and health scientific congress in Rome. So I'm going to get a Guinness at Frankfurt Airport. Now, let's get off this very uncomfortable topic. What are we talking about this week?
Okay. I'm going to pick it up on the next episode.
Yeah, relentless. You're relentless.
I am. Anyway, so today, today's question comes from Claire, who lives in Hong Kong. So yes, full disclosure, she is one of my drinks curious friends, as you've now termed them, Felicity.
Does she work in the drinks trade at some level?
No, she doesn't. Yeah, but she had listened to our episode on award-winning wines.
An excellent episode. Everyone should listen to it.
Oh, of course, of course. So having listened to that episode, she sent me a WhatsApp message with a question. And she said, as I have a partner who doesn't drink wine, I almost never open a bottle of wine at home. And on date nights when we're out, I'm usually confined to drinking wine by the glass. I wish there were more half bottles of wine available or even wine in cans. Although she did add, although I can't get over my perception that only crap wine comes in cans. And she finished her message off saying, answers on a postcard or podcast, please.
Do you know, it's a really good question. And in fact, it's something I've often asked myself. I also wish there were more small format bottles available. Okay, but it's an interesting question and there is an answer. But maybe to start, we should talk about why wine comes in a 750ml bottle in the first place.
Yeah, well, it was really interesting, Felicity, because until Claire asked the question, I suppose I hadn't really given it enough thought as to why wine does come in 75 centilitre bottles. So I've worked in the business of wine for over 30 years, and I guess I kind of just accepted that that's the sort of standard unit of wine. So the logical question is, I guess, why is it not 500 cl, sort of half a litre or 1 litre or a pint or indeed any other measurement? So why 75? Why have we ended up there in the world of wine?
Well, we have to go back in history to understand how that came about.
Good. So we're going to get one of your history lessons for this.
Right. It's a bit like the story about how railroad tracks today are mimicking the old Roman horse carts. Lasts for a long time. Okay, so the basic unit of measurement for most liquid products in most places in the world is 1 litre, or it's a pint, as you say. But the most popular size of wine bottle is 750 mils, and this was standardised in the 18th century, and there are lots of theories about why this is.
Oh, I love a theory. And if I'm correct, I do recall, or I've heard something that's got something to do with glass blowers. Gosh, you have to say that carefully, don't you? Glass blowers' lung capacity.
That is one of the theories, that when glass bottles were originally made, they were effectively, you know, you had a real person, a glass blower, to create the bottle. And you're right that in theory, the lung capacity of your average glass blower is about 600 to 800 millilitres. And so it just naturally turned out that glass bottles turned out to be about 750 mils.
Okay, well, that seems quite implausible, or at least improbable to me, because surely it depends on who the glass blower was. So if it was a really big guy, and I guess I'm kind of assuming it was a bloke, that were blowing glass bottles, then surely he would blow a bigger bottle than a really small guy that was doing it. So
I googled, as you can tell, I look under every rock when it comes to research, that the average lung capacity is this between 600 and 800. But, you know, I'm sure it's been lost to history, but I'm sure there were some very, very little people making very, very little bottles. Maybe they were the perfume bottle makers. I don't know.
Okay. So you've now disclosed, is this Felicity, the award-winning international journalist, revealing
That's right. The other theory is that the 750ml is the right size for accompanying a meal.
Okay, so again, surely it depends on how many people are sharing the meal and how many glasses of wine you'd like to drink with your meal. So how does that work if you're having a meal for one or a meal for six? How can the same size of bottle be ideal for both?
I don't know. There was probably an average family size. It was probably the average family was, I don't know, six kids, two parents. I don't know. Anyway, but like all of these theories, they're probably more mythical than reality, I guess.
Yeah. So what's the real story then? There must be something that's a bit more credible and logical for the 75cl wine bottle.
Well, it turns out that neither of these theories are true. In reality, the format was created because of trade between France and Great Britain. And actually, we owe it, as with many things, to the Bordeaux trade.
Yeah. So often, as is the case, it comes from commercial and economic impact factors.
That's right. So in the 19th century, mostly it was British who were importing French wines, though the Dutch did as well. But at the time, the French were already using the litre as a unit of measurement because they were rational. But the English were still using the imperial gallon. So 1 gallon was about 4.55 litres. And so the conversion from one measure to another was not obvious.
Okay, well, that's an understatement, because that conversion rate is actually really difficult to do. So as a Brit, I've been brought up with miles and pints and feet and inches, etc., as my units of measurement. So now I'm wondering why some countries and cultures in the world adopt certain units of measurement, which are different in other countries. So Felicity, given your encyclopedic knowledge, which we all know about now, I lay about on the fact that you know something about that.
It's because we prefer doing easy mathematics at school. And dividing by 10 as per the metric system is just so much easier than the imperial system. That is the answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay. So going back to wine bottles, you still haven't explained how we ended up with 750 mils.
Well, it was because the Bordelais liked easy calculations too. So a 225-litre barrel is 50 imperial gallons, and that equates to exactly 300 bottles of 750 mils, which makes calculations and packaging much easier to manage. So because this made trading easier, you get things like the establishment of 6-bottle cases, which is the equivalent to 1 gallon. Which is nice.
Ah, okay, so I get it now. So I get that for Bordeaux, but I recall, isn't Burgundy different? Aren't the barrel sizes different in Burgundy?
So in Burgundy, the barrel size is, for some reason, or 228 litres. But most of the international trade was with Bordeaux because it sits on a port. So Burgundy's wines had to be transported overland. And as a result, sometimes the barrels would just fall apart. So Burgundy never had the commercial impact on the world that Bordeaux did.
Mm-mm. So I'm just going back to the point you just made. I've learned something that I didn't know, and I again just took for granted, which is why wine comes in units of half cases of 6 bottles or full cases of 12 bottles. And again, I suppose I'd never really thought about why it wasn't like 5 and 10 as opposed to 6 and 12. Yay, so I've learned something today,
well,
thank you.
So this is a really funny thing. So the first time I bought eggs in Germany, I asked for 12 because I didn't know the word for, you know, a dozen. And they stared at me and they told me the egg cartons only went to 10. They thought I was really weird.
Okay.
Which I guess actually it is really weird to ask for 12.
Well, I suppose because we've been brought up on dozen, haven't we, for that.
Yeah, that's right.
It's bizarre how these different products and categories kind of have their units of measurement, which is what we're talking about. So that's cleared up the 75 cl unit or 750 mil unit for wine, and wine's measured in multiples or fractions in the case of half bottle that Claire was asking about. But to complicate things further, you can also get 50 cl bottles. But thinking about bottle size and about magnums, for example, so that's a double bottle size, 1.5 litres, I suppose I'm thinking it's really interesting that there are different perceptions of wine magnum bottles.
Can you explain what you mean by different perceptions of wine served in magnum bottles?
Yeah. So what I was thinking about there, let's take the US market, for example, where there's a higher proportion compared to many other markets of wine sold in 1.5 litre bottles. And they're primarily wines that are sort of entry level in terms of pricing.
Is that your polite British way of saying cheap?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So the majority in the US, so the majority of the 1.5, to your phrase, cheap wines are more kind of mainstream every day. So the perception when I've done the sort of research with sort of, you know, typical wine drinkers in the US, everyday wine drinkers, is that magnums, and they don't actually call them magnums, typically consumers, they would say large bottles, are typically seen as delivering, yeah, which is fair enough, good value for money, particularly for parties or when socialising.
Well, I suppose they literally do. And I suppose that really contrasts with the perception of Bordeaux and a magnum, for example, which is all about prestige, luxury, fine wine. You mentioned rosé wine on a recent episode, that your daughter had a magnum of it, and that's partly that's driving the success of premium rosé.
Yeah, and the perception, again, and talking to and researching with consumers, you know, multiple markets, particularly for rosé magnums, they're really associated, as you were just saying, with the sort of special occasion, treat, reward, sociability. So I'm finding it interesting that magnums can have these really different perceptions amongst wine drinkers, either from where you are in the world or depending on what wine is in that magnum bottle.
Yeah, now I'm thinking about champagne in magnum bottles.
Mm, yeah. And so we keep using the term magnum. So we know that that's a two bottle size, so 1.5 litres. And I know that four bottle equivalent, so that's 3 litres, is called a Jeroboam. And then you go up through this kind of long list of weird and wonderful names like Methuselah and Balthazar for the different size bottles. So over to my history correspondent, explain to me where these names come from and actually what they mean, because I don't think I really know. And I'm guessing that bottle size as everything leads us back to France.
I will explain those names, but I just want to interject with the French thing that you just said. Not everything comes from France. Okay. So a few years ago, I went to Henkel Fresenay, which is a German company, and they're headquartered in this very beautiful historic building. Now, today, they're the world's largest sparkling wine company, but they started as a traditional sect company.
Yeah. And they now produce sparkling wine from all locations around the world, don't they? And sect, you were just talking about there being the German term for sparkling wine.
That's right. Anyway, Germany is crazy for sect. So it's a very important part of the culture. Anyway, along all the walls, Henkel have this advertising from the 1930s. And it's really lovely as it is from that period. But many of the pictures that they're most proud of feature their Piccolo, which is a 200ml bottle. So this was introduced in Germany in 1935. It became an icon, and it particularly took off in the post-World War II period because money was really tight. So it was this little piece of luxury.
Yeah, well, so the French have managed to adopt it. So do you remember that Moët Hennessy began introducing vending machines? It was in Selfridge's department store, so premium department store here in London, and they had a vending machine.
God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay, so that tells you a lot about the prestige of champagne. So, you know, if they'd put little bottles of vodka mix in there, you could just imagine going, oh, how irresponsible, because it's champagne. What a great idea. Okay, so let's go back to the Magnum and the big bottles. The Magnum was a French invention, and those really big bottles were already selling in pre-revolutionary France, but they were made in Britain.
Okay, so do you know why they called them what they did? So those weird and wonderful names I was referring to.
So there's a great article in the magazine Falstaff that explains this. It says that the double magnum was probably called the Jeroboam to infer luxury, because the biblical Jeroboam had commissioned some very lavish architecture, plus he specialised in golden statues.
Yeah, okay. Well, he sounds like a very good bloke. So then we've got like Methuselah, Salomazar, I talk about Balthazar, you know, we get to names like Nebuchadnezzar's, and then increasingly ridiculous sizes. So one of my favourites being Goliath, which is, you know, does what it says on the tin, well, bottle, which is 36 standard bottles, and then the Midas, which is 40 standard bottles.
Do you know, I've been reporting on wine for more than 20 years now, maybe 25 years. I've never seen any of these things. Does anyone actually make them, or are they just sort of a myth?
Well, no, they do. And it's done, for, you know, quite rightly for sort of awareness and luxury positioning reasons. So I'm thinking of Armand de Brujac, Brut Gold Champagne, and they produced a 30-litre Midas bottle, which was, if I remember, it was sold in London for about £120,000 to a US businessman in the kind of like 2010, 2011. But I think they only made 6 bottles of them. So they're really developed for this kind of high-end, premium, luxury kind of awareness, brand building.
That's right, because you've got to have your own crane or high one to deliver it. And you also need specialist help just to open the thing. So we have to emphasise these bottles are vanishingly rare because of this kind of ridiculousness.
Yeah, but that's kind of almost the point, isn't it? Which is it's that prestige that we were talking about. But the Magnums really went into production in the early 19th century, as I recall, for the Russian court signify. And again, it's this kind of signification of wealth.
Yes. And so when these bottles really begin to take off, Magnums I'm talking about, they start to appear in champagne in the late 19th century, around about 1880. So, Luli, apart from the sheer wealth and extravagance required to produce them, do these bottles have a point?
Well, so looking beyond the kind of schmancy and prestigious, the larger bottles, yes, from a technical point of view, wine does age differently, if the same wine, if it's in different size bottles. So large bottles have the ratio of air to liquid is different. So the it's lower in larger bottles compared to smaller ones, hence giving us a different aging of wine.
Okay, so you're the data person. I'm sure there's some data coming up. How much wine is actually sold outside of the 750ml package? I can't imagine there are too many Nebuchadnezzars, the 15-litre bottles being sold.
No, and I haven't managed to dig up any research because I suppose nobody's really focused on it that much in terms of the sort of super large bottles. But if we think about Magnums, for example, so the 1.5s, we can kind of look in the US market and see how it's different there compared to other places.
Right. Hit me with data. I want data. Hit me with it.
Oh, thank you. I thought you'd never ask me for it. So according to IWSR, amongst regular wine drinkers in the US, around 30% of regular wine drinkers buy wine in these large, what they call larger formats, so 1.5-litre bottles.
Wow, that's huge. I wouldn't have expected that at
all. Okay. Yeah, and yeah, so that was the point I was making earlier, that these, as you said, cheap, I said value wines come, you know, more often delivered in that format in the US. But let's compare that, Felicity, to your homeland of Australia. And if we look there, it's only around 10% of wine drinkers there are buying the larger format. So it's roughly three times as many people in the US compared to Australia. So quick quiz. What format, talking of Australia, beyond 75 centilitres, so the standard size bottle, is most popular in Australia?
Okay, I'm going to guess here, but I think I'm on firm ground by saying it's the bag-in-box.
You are correct, but it's not just any old bag and box, Felicity. It's the 4 or 5 litre cask, again, according to IWSR data. So two things to note there. First, that casks are often referred to as box wine, bag in box. It depends where you are in the world. And the second point is that these 4 or 5 litre casks, that's terminology, as you know, used in Australia, is around 5 to 6.5 standard bottles of wine. So that's quite a lot of wine in one packaging format.
But you've missed out the most important point, which is that they were invented in Australia.
We have. And does that mean I get to talk more about consumers and data?
Yes, 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 you do. But first of all, I have to talk about bag-in-box.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so basically bag-in-box is a system where there's a flexible plastic bag or polyurethane or something inside that contains the wine, and it's inside a cardboard box that typically has a tap mechanism attached. So the system was originally created in the US by the Scholl family for, check this, the storage of battery acid.
Oh my goodness me. So surely there's a joke in that related to battery acid and the quality of wine in bag-in-box.
Yes, thank you for your restraint. We appreciate it. Anyway, in 1965, Thomas Angove, a winemaker from South Australia, repurposed the bag-in-box, patenting a system with a polyurethane bladder inside a corrugated cardboard. A couple of years later, it was refined by Charles Malpass and Penfolds Wine, who introduced a plastic airtight tap welded into what's called an aluminized film bladder. And voila, you can have up to 20 litres of wine on your shelf and it lasts for weeks.
So that must have had actually quite a big impact on the market.
Yes, in both a negative and a positive way. Okay, so on the one hand, it made wine an everyday drink. And so I think it helped, you know, the wine boom. On the other hand, and this is a very negative, it made huge quantities of wine available at a very cheap price, which had a massive social impact in different communities, particularly Indigenous communities, where it had a very deleterious impact. So it became associated with cheapness and drunkenness, which wrecked the reputation of what was in fact a very good invention.
Yeah, and knowing Australia and my lovely friends in Australia, you included, I'm guessing there are some euphemisms here.
Well, we are the, you know, we are the people who call the morning after driving the porcelain bus. So, yes, we do. Okay, so it was called Chateau Cardboard, Goon Juice and the Red Handbag. And depending on which country towns you hated, you might call it the Dubbo Handbag or the Dapto Briefcase.
Okay, so only in Australia, Felicity.
Yeah, that's right.
But bag-in-box doesn't have that cheap image now, particularly now, everywhere. So I'm thinking in Sweden, for example. So that's one of the markets in the world with the highest proportion of consumers who purchase wine in the bag in box format. But in their case, Felicity, it's primarily 3 litres as opposed to the 4 or 5 litres favoured in Australia. So Swedish wine drinkers primarily purchase the bag in box wine. And then, as they say, through research, because it delivers better value for money and is more convenient to carry and store at home.
Yeah. And of course, Sweden's what's called a monopoly market, which means the government strictly controls the sale of alcohol. So in such a market, it's actually better value to go and stock up on a bag in box than to buy it bottle by bottle.
Yeah, yeah. And people often buy bag-in-box format during the week, for example. So the wine they're drinking sort of at home every day. And then they'll buy exactly the same brand or type of wine in a bottle, in a 75 centilitre bottle, if they're taking it to a friend's house or out for dinner. So it's the same wine, but just in different formats.
Yeah. And in many markets like the UK, I think, the trend towards moderation means that people value a format where they can pour themselves a glass of wine. And that's it for the evening until next time. You know, you don't have to manage a whole bottle. So you're seeing the rise of premium bag-in-box, and now you even get the Bagnum, which is a pouch that dispenses wine without having the cardboard box.
So anyway, we've strayed off from talking about the 75 centilitre increments and the 12 bottle cases. We've discussed a lot about wine in larger formats,
yes,
but Claire's question was actually about smaller formats, and specifically half bottles and cans and why there aren't more of them.
Yes, I agree with this. And if anybody's listening who's in charge of this stuff, please put out more smaller formats. Why aren't there more smaller formats?
Well, I think the key reason, Felicity, that we don't see more half bottles in particular is simply down to one of economics and costs.
Okay, you're going to have to talk me through that.
Okay, so well, let's start by breaking down the costs that go into a bottle of wine. So I phoned a friend to get some help with the most up-to-date data on this to get
you
the
phoned
input
a
cost.
Friend, and which friend was that, Lily?
Okay, so actually it was my dad.
You're just surrounded by this. Now your Christmas tree drink decorations are coming into focus for me.
Okay, so the reason, it's not just because he's my dad, but he is, yeah. But he is the reason I started working wine, actually, all those years
ago.
Really?
I didn't know
that. Yes. So dad and I used to run, very many years ago, a wine importing business.
Did you?
Yes, we were importing wine from smaller, mainly family producers, started off in southern France, but sort of extended.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And then we'd bring them into the UK. So otherwise they weren't available in the UK. And we'd ship them in directly into our warehouse in the UK. And then we'd sell them to kind of higher end retailers and restaurants
did
and
that
bars.
Did that mean dad and daughter buying trips to France?
Yes.
Oh, wow. What a nice thing to do.
Yeah, it did. So one of the key things we had to do was work out what price the wines would end up on the shelf at in the UK, so either in the shops or the restaurants, based on the price we were buying it from the producers. So we had to kind of calculate the price in to include shipping costs, retailer margins, duty tax, and sales tax. So I asked Dad last week to recreate that spreadsheet, what that we called the price calculator that we used to use, and update it with the current data in terms of tax and input costs and things for this podcast. So are you ready for this?
Can I just say once again how impressed I am? I mean, you just go all out for this. Spreadsheets, trips to Dublin. I mean, there's nothing you won't do for the podcast. And yeah. I haven't had the Guinness yet. I'm feeling ashamed. Okay, so hit me with the data. Go for it.
Okay, so this is where we get quite complicated. So I'm going to try and make it accessible and straightforward without overcomplicating. So I've taken a sort of an example. So let's say we imported or we got a bottle of wine from France at 13% ABV, because of course we're even more complicated now in the UK because we have different tax rates depending on the ABV or alcohol level of the wine. So if we say we were importing a bottle of wine and we paid about €1.50 to the producer, that would end up in a UK supermarket at about £7.80, so
wow.
Just under £8. So you
oh my God, so yeah. Were you making huge money from those huge margins?
No, not at all, because you've got to add in shipping costs, you've then got to have your margin as an importer, you've then got to have the retailer margin But the most significant part of that is the tax and duty. And then you've got to put sales tax on top of that as well.
God, wow.
So by the time you've put all of those margins and taxes, actually the margin for the importer, the margin for the producer, and the margin for the retailer is actually pretty minimal. So in the example I was giving you there, so we've got this €1.80 you're paying to the producer, ends up on the shelf at about £8 in the UK, just under. So that means that about 15-16%, so £1.25 of that £8 is what you're actually paying to the producer. And that's the bit that's known as the ex-seller price, what you pay as an importer to the producer.
Yeah, it's not much, is it? And that ex-seller price includes all the producer's costs, which is growing or buying the grapes, making the wine, and the bottle, and any other, you know, dry good costs associated with it.
Yeah. And as a grape grower myself now, I am fully aware of the costs of simply just growing the grapes and getting to that point, let alone then getting the grapes into the winery, getting the wine produced, and then getting it bottled. So that means that, you know, when you've taken out those costs from the producer aspect, it's about 70 or 80 pence worth of that wine is what is actually going towards the wine costs that the producers are using, and you're paying £8 for it.
Oh my God. Okay. My head is spinning.
Yeah, okay, so I'm going to go with another one. So let me, I'm in danger of making this more complicated. If we double the costs paid to the wine producer, so now I'm an importer and instead of paying €1.50 for my bottle, I'm paying €3. That wine would typically end up on a UK supermarket shelf. And again, it depends who, which retailer, which margins, but broadly at around £10. So now we've gone to about 25% of the price we've paid as a consumer is the cost paid to the producer. So we've gone from €3 to the producer to £10 on the shelf.
I guess that must mean that if you just pay, you as a consumer just pay a little bit more, you're getting actually a huge increase in wine quality.
Yeah, it does. So spending just £2 more, so from £8 to £10 on a bottle of wine when you're in a retailer here in the UK, doubles the proportion of the cost that's going into the actual wine itself.
Okay, so to be really clear, I double the quality of the wine if I increase my spend from £8 to £10.
Effectively, yes.
Okay, so how does this all work for half bottles?
Okay, so now if we take the half bottle, so 37.5 centiliter half bottle, the producer costs aren't halved. So that's the key to it. So that's what I was talking about, the economics earlier. So the cost of running a bottling line are effectively the same. In fact, can be more expensive because there are fewer half bottle bottling lines available. So it's a bit of a curse of supply and demand there.
Right. And of course, you've still got all your other costs like corks or screw caps and labels and so on.
Yeah, which are pretty similar. So proportionally, a half bottle isn't half that of a regular bottle. And that comes to the bottle, physical bottle itself, because it's not half the weight of a standard bottle, because it's all to do with glass thickness and surface area to volume ratios. But anyway, without getting too technical, suffice to say the production costs of bottling and shipping for half bottles of wine are not half of that of a full bottle.
So it's actually proportionally much more expensive, which I guess is why you see half bottles of very, very expensive wines, because it makes sense.
Yes. So I can always rely on you to more eloquently summarise all of my data ramblings.
I guess why then is the Piccolo viable given how popular it is?
Well, I suppose it's because what you were talking about earlier when you mentioned Henkel Freshenet as the world's biggest sparkling wine company. So because they're producing the volume that they are, I'm guessing that allows them to run the appropriate bottling lines, for example, and more importantly, buy in the glass bottles in sufficient quantities to bring some of those production costs down.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess that also would suggest that champagne has the margins to do it. So What it also means is if you don't have huge quantities or if you don't have nice thick margins from a very expensive product, then tiny formats are just not economic. Mm. I guess that's why those little bottles of wine that are served on some airlines come in PET or plastic format because, obviously there's the glass weight, which you don't want on a flight, but obviously it's just not viable for the airline.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I did a project actually for Virgin Airlines a number of years ago, and a lot of that actually is exactly the point you were making. It's about weight.
Yeah.
Is a significant factor because that it obviously impacts fuel economy of aeroplanes. So weight and storage capacity is a lot to do with that.
Now I'm thinking through. I guess you don't want a breakable on an airline as well. It could become a danger.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and we could go at a full tangent. Maybe we'll come back to transport and airlines. Let's come back to that because lots to say on airlines and glass and bottles and wine and all sorts of things. Anyway, so back to bottle format. So yes, another economic driver of not having lots of half bottles available is to do with sort of stock management. So in either shops or in restaurants, you just have too many SKUs for the retailers operate. So stock keeping units, SKUs. So each individual line basically is an SKU. So you'd have to manage more of these if you were having more half bottles. So it would increase the complexity for the retailer. It would add to the stock management and most importantly to the inventory costs. So you simply wouldn't have the shelf space to dedicate to what would be slower moving lines.
Yeah. And I guess that makes sense from another perspective, which is that if you're, in a big retailer like a supermarket, every single, centimetre has to perform and it's not just within wine, it's across everything. All right, so let's talk about another small format. Let's talk about cans because it's another debt the world owes to Australia.
Really? So Australia comes back again, not that you're biased or anything. So I do know some stuff about cans, but please enlighten me with the history.
Well, I know about this because I did a story about this in 2005 for the Melbourne Age newspaper. Mm. So I went to look it up and what was really annoying is when I tried to find my own work, I ran into the paywall.
No,
I couldn't access
seriously.
It. Yeah, so I had to go. Fortunately, I keep really good archives, so I went and actually found it.
Okay, so was it worth it?
Well, you'll have to be the judge. Okay, so people first started putting wine in cans in the 1930s, but it was disastrous because, the wine would react with the metal, it would eat through the can, it would get moldy, it would oxidize, all sorts of bad things. Anyway, in 1996, an Australian called Greg Stokes knocked a glass of wine into a jacuzzi and he had to deal with the shards of glass. So he decided then and then he was going to develop wine in a can, and his solution was to put a plastic liner into the can that would keep out the mold and, keep it free of oxidation and so on.
Okay, so I've got lots of thoughts here. First, I want to know if Greg Stokes, did you say, yeah?
Stokes,
was
yeah.
a regular jacuzzi user.
Well, I guess once he got the glass out, probably.
Okay, and what was the end of that story then? How did it end?
He patented the system. It's called Baroque's system, but it didn't. It solved the problem, but it didn't solve the problem because, when people coated the plastic, sometimes they didn't coat the aluminium all the way and there were problems. Or sometimes you'd get problems with hydrogen sulfide aromas, you'd get rotten egg smell. And sometimes, like I said, the wine would touch the can. So there'd be all sorts of problems as a result. So not every can that you pulled off the shelf would be pristine.
And so these problems have kind of been resolved now?
Yeah, they have. And actually quite recently. So for my Drinks Insider podcast, if I can just slot
okay,
that in
promote
there,
your other podcast, why don't you?
I interviewed Marion Leitner-Waldman of Archer Roos. She's one of the smartest people I've ever spoken to. Now, she makes...
Can I just say, I loved that episode.
Oh, thank you.
I really enjoyed listening to it. So
oh,
I would
thank
say
you.
To,
she's
no,
fantastic.
She's cracking, isn't she?
She's really good. Well, what she decided to do was she went to a rock concert and couldn't get anything decent to drink. So she decided that she wanted to put high-quality wine into cans and sell them at, rock concerts. Her goal is a Taylor Swift concert. concert. But because she uses high quality wines, she needed them to be perfect. So she went to Cornell University, which has a very good research department about wine, to solve the problem. And they did solve the problem and they released the research to everybody. So so the problem has been solved. And don't ask me what technical issue it was. I have no idea. But I do know you still need a high quality canning line to do this. And not everybody has the expertise. So you can still have some not very good wines in cans. But overall, canned wines are now pretty stable and pretty high quality.
Yeah, yeah. So I know the key issue with wine in cans has been the sulfur, as you said earlier, and this can be generated due to the reaction between the chemical compounds in wine and the can liner that's used. So I was back in March 2020, I was over in Washington State speaking at their sort of annual conference, and I went to a great session on can liners, would you believe?
Two hours. I would believe it. Unfortunately, I would believe it, yeah.
I actually really enjoyed it.
Did you?
So the very much more knowledgeable winemakers and canning experts who were running the session, clearly than me, were explaining why this happened. But the bit I really took away from that was why we don't get this same issue, for example, with beer or soft drinks that we do with wine when it goes into a can. And as they explained it, and again, I won't repeat their technicals, probably because I'll get them wrong, but it's to do with the chemical compounds that are different in wine to, for example, in beer and soft drinks. So after that session, I went to the local supermarket in the town I was, where the conference was in Washington State, the local Safeway, and I bought 10 cans of wine.
10 cans of wine?
And I opened them all in my hotel room in the evening and did the kind of sniff test and taste test on them to see whether there were kind of sulfur aromas or anything coming out of them. And of the 10 cans, I would say, I think it was like 7 or 8 of the 10 definitely had some sulfur aromas. Now, this was back in 2020.
All right. So, I should ask you about sulfur aromas, but I've got different questions. My questions are, did you drink them all? And secondly, what did you do with the cans? Were you worried about what the housekeeping people would think when they came in and found all your cans?
Yeah, so no, I didn't drink all of them. I'm really sure. And mainly I didn't drink most of them, because back this, you know, this is 5 years ago when the you know, we hadn't quite worked out the can lining bit for wine as well as we have. And actually quite a lot of them were not really very good quality because of this kind of sulfur problem. And no, I just put them all in the bin and I just thought, well, if housekeeping can make what they want of me and me being at a
conference. And they did, Luli, they did.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I do know that the technology, as to your point, has really been improving. So when I was at the Australian Wine Industry Technical Conference in 2022, so 2 years after that, I attended... Okay, get it this time. A 3-hour technical workshop on cans and canning.
I don't know why we don't just have this whole episode about cans, because you've probably got a lot of knowledge locked up in your head.
Yeah, but I'm not sure everybody would like me to share all of that knowledge. Anyway, so progress was really being made to mitigate this kind of sulfur issue.
Okay, so what has been the market response to canned wines, apart from crazy people who go and buy 10 at once?
Okay, so according to Grand View Research, the global market for canned wines, so this is not the most recent data, but gives us a sort of an approximate. So in 2021 was around $235 million and is expected to rise to $570 million by 2028. And if we go back to 2014, basically what they're saying is it's a 30-fold increase. So huge growth from a very small base proportionally, but still really huge growth. So the increase in popularity of canned wines is attributed to several reasons, including things like being more convenient, the lightweight design, as you were talking about earlier, the ability to have wine at different events, particularly where glass isn't available, established recycling channels, and, you know, the sort of the multi-occasion usage. Now, the quality issues that we were just talking about in our previous conversation have mostly been sorted, and we're seeing more premium wine in cans, as you said. Also plays well to the moderation trend that we're seeing in general.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about different formats, and we know that fine wine collectors like magnums and big formats because they have aging potential and because you can show them off. But what about smaller formats? What's driving this increase in things like wine in cans?
Yeah, so I think there's a really important kind of socioeconomic or sociodemographic, I should say, factor. Sociodemographics being one of my favourite topics. Right.
I want to hear about it. Tell me about it.
Okay. So we have an increasing proportion. So I think this is impacting smaller formats and cans, I imagine, more specifically. So we have an increasing proportion of what we call single adult households, which basically means on average we're getting married or finding our life partners later and having children later than we had done previously. So in the US, according to the Census Bureau and Pew Research Center, so if we go back to sort of 1970, about a third of adults aged between 25 and 34 were single. By 2020, that rose to a half of adults that age group being single.
Yeah. Talk about the loneliness epidemic. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So it's really different. So there's been this really quite important socio-demographic impact. And that's what we term, you know, sort of Ponzi marketing term, we would call it single and solo lifestyles. But it's really impacted purchase priorities. So smaller households, for example, you know, not surprisingly, prefer convenience, ease of use, and of course, smaller sized or single serve products.
Yeah. I guess we should change the subject a bit and talk about sustainability, because there are questions over all of these, you know, these forms of packaging. So is it better to buy a bag and box that might have a plastic liner, but you're using less packaging overall because you've got more wine? Or is it better to buy a small format glass that needs recycling, but which has a higher carbon footprint per bottle and so on?
Yeah. So let's just talk about glass for a moment. And by the way, when you, again, do research with wine consumers, with regular wine drinkers, pretty much any market in the world that I've researched in anyway, consumers say that they think that wine in glass bottles is pretty sustainable. Because from, you know, consumer perception, glass is recyclable, so therefore it's a sustainable packaging.
Yeah, but it turns out it's not that simple. So as probably a lot of people know, Jancis Robinson, the London-based renowned wine critic and author, she's been a vocal advocate for reducing the carbon footprint associated with wine packaging by promoting the use of lighter bottles. So what she's highlighted is that the production and transportation of glass is a significant portion of wine's environmental impact. She wrote an article called "Are Lighter Bottles in Sight?" and she discussed the challenges producers face in sourcing glass bottles and suggested that adopting lightweight bottles could alleviate these issues. And she noted that there's an international group of retailers actively researching effective methods to reduce the carbon footprint of wine packaging, with lightweighting being a key focus.
Yeah. And I recall that Jancis also talked about the misconception that heavier bottles signify higher quality wine. So I remember actually when I was doing a focus group research with wine drinkers in the UK, it was a number of years ago, we were testing the perceptions of different wine brands. So we had this, you know, sort of big selection of wine bottles on the table that everybody was discussing to get their feedback. And a number of drinkers commented that they wouldn't buy one of the particular brands that was on the table because, to quote them, it was smaller and had less wine in it.
Yeah, you actually hear this a lot in markets that are developing a taste for wine, that they can't sell bottles unless they're very, very heavy and embossed because it gives a lot of sort of confidence to the buyer. But I just want to go back on a point you just made. So we've established that all bottles are 750 mils. So what bottle was it that your research group was talking about? A smaller bottle or What?
No, no. No. So, you know, all of the bottles on the table were 75 centilitres.
Right.
So they were all, but the consumer perception was that because some looked, well, they physically are shorter, they assumed that there was less wine in them because they were thinner glass, so lighter weight, and also didn't have the deep punt. And again, surprise, you have to be very careful when saying out loud. So the punt being the dimple in the bottle of the bottom of the bottle. So it just makes, basically, it makes the bottle appear shorter than the others.
Yeah, so we still haven't solved the question of whether small formats are ecologically sustainable or not. I am guessing that they're going to have a much higher footprint.
Yeah, and it all depends on how and whether they're recycled and how environmentally friendly, for example, are cans.
Well, this is an interesting one. People assume that they're terrible, but actually they have a lot of things going for them.
Okay, but there's something to do, isn't there something to do with bauxite mining being terrible for the environment?
Yes, it's what you get the aluminium from, but absolutely it's terrible for the environment, but so is sand mining, which is what you need for glass. So most sand mining happens for other reasons, like it's used for, use in the oil and gas industry, but sand mining for glass causes coastal erosion and loss of habitat. This isn't so much of a problem if the glass is recycled, but mostly it's not recycled. Mm. So in Germany and Switzerland, about 80% of glass containers are recycled, but only 33% are recycled in the US and the rest go to landfill. And not only that, but of course glass shatters, which means it can't be recycled at all.
Yeah, so that's really interesting because the reality of glass recycling doesn't match up to the perception when I was just talking previously about the kind of consumer perception of that glass is environmentally friendly. But back to cans, you're not convincing me about aluminium smelting and using the huge amount of energy that it does.
Well, that's true whatever you do. So glass making uses, huge high temperature furnaces. Mm. But the difference with aluminium cans is that more than 70% of the metal that you will find in any given can is already recycled material. And although, you can put a can in landfill or it can disappear into the environment, in theory, you can recover it later and recycle it. And in fact, about 70 plus percent of all aluminium currently in the world is recycled.
Wow,
and you can recycle it forever and ever. So, for example, one of the fun facts is that if it goes into a high temperature incinerator to burn trash, it'll actually get scraped out the bottom. So it gets recovered there as well.
Okay. That's fascinating. So you might have convinced me on that, but then we've still got the plastic liners.
Yeah, they are a problem, right? There's no doubt about that. If they're not properly disposed of, then you get microplastics entering the environment. Mm. But overall, the most important thing is cans are much more likely to enter the recycling stream, and that's true pretty much everywhere in the world. And they're also lighter to transport.
Yeah, and we were talking about sort of transport and shipping costs and impacts from an economic point of view earlier, but also now obviously thinking of layering in the kind of sustainability. So Felicity, as we are learning, you are much better at summarising.
I don't think that's true, Lily, but thank you.
I am. So back to the why doesn't more wine come in half bottle or can format?
So obviously the key reason we've worked out is economics and costs when it comes to half bottles. The input costs of a half bottle are not those of a whole bottle, so it's proportionally more expensive to make and buy. We will probably see more small formats with cans, but there are sort of consumer perceptions to overcome.
Yeah, which is why we primarily see half bottles for more expensive wine. So for example, for champagne.
That's right. But the economics will work for smaller bottles like the Piccolo if the company is operating at a significant enough scale for the cost of goods and operational goods to come down.
Yeah. And for wine in cans, we're expecting this to continue growing. So we'll see more wine in cans, particularly now that the technical production issues have largely been resolved. And we'll also see more of a shift to premium wine in cans, which supports the socio-demographic and economic trends of single and solo lifestyle, for example, but also the very dominant global trend of moderation.
Yeah, all right. So to answer your friend Claire's question, we'd suggest that she gives wine in cans a go and potentially move on from her perception that wine in cans is crap, which is her term, not ours.
Indeed it was. So, Felicity, another drinks question solved, but a co-host who has yet to try her first pint of Guinness, not solved.
Oh, I know. I will solve that in time for our next episode. I'm going to do it this week while passing through an airport. And until next time, you have been listening to A Question of Drinks.
You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.